warning. The Catholic Man Show contains high levels of manliness. If you think you may be too weak to withstand the manliness represented in the following program, please do yourself a favor and stop listening now. If you choose to continue in spite of this warning, if at any time you feel yourself overcome by the manliness, stop immediately and consult your closest medical professional. And now, for the not so fair, faint, or frilly, we present The Catholic Man Show.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We are on the Lord's team, the winning side. So raise your glass. I am Adam Minahan, sitting here in studio. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go impromptu. I'm going to stand.
Just like that, huh?
Just like that, I'm going to stand. I was sitting, and now I feel like that I need to stand. So I'm going to stand. That's what I'm going to do. I'm standing here with my co-host, David Niles.
You know, we make a big deal about our posture here on the show. And I'm going to just say, I think we over-exaggerate the topic. It's not that big of a deal.
I agree with you, actually. We really do. We really pinpoint exactly how we are, our posture. However, you know, in the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis writes, you know, the devil was like, try to make them feel like that it doesn't matter what posture they're in while they're praying.
Yeah.
So.
The devil is such a sleazebag.
So, I mean, that's important. Posture is important.
Okay, I agree.
I don't think it's important for our show, but yeah. Posture.
What if we did this not on the show, just we're like made a routine of announcing your posture? I'm sitting.
Be very
just
weird.
Want everyone to know I'm sitting.
That'd be very weird.
I'm gonna stand up now.
I'm gonna move on with the show now.
Okay.
The show, The Catholic Man Show, we have a special guest this episode.
Very excited about it.
I'm going to spoil it.
Okay.
Steve Weidenkopf.
There you go.
Professor Steve Weidenkopf is going to be on our show here in the third segment.
Yeah, otherwise known as the Encyclopedia.
Yeah, he gives Jimmy Akin a good run for his money. Totally. I would love to just be a fly in the wall listening to them
How do you think we could score like a knowledge off? It's like, yeah, I know that too. Sorry, no points.
No points allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we could do that. Anyway, Dave, why don't you kindly let them know what we do on the Catholic Man Show?
Okay. If this is your first time.
I would like you to kindly do this.
If this is your first time listening to the Catholic Man Show, we do three things here on the show every week. The first thing we do, which you're going to love, is we open, review, and enjoy a manly beverage. We do it manfully. The second thing we do...
Are you saying that you have to, like, drinking... In order to be a man, you have to drink?
I didn't say that. I'm just saying that's what we do on the show.
Just kind of assumed that that's what you're meaning.
Well, that would be a logical fallacy.
Okay. Would that be a straw man?
I don't know what
that
it's called.
That would be a
straw man. But it's just when you assume things that I didn't say with my mouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do we drink on the show, Dave?
Okay. Kindly.
Kindly, please let me know.
We drink on the show because God made the things of this earth good. If you don't believe me, ask the book of Genesis. And those things should be enjoyed for their goodness. And so here on the Catholic Man Show, we embrace God's creation in the form of whiskey, in moderation, of course. Because...
Does moderation look the same for everybody?
No, of course not.
That would not be a good thing to think.
Like, for instance, your dad is very large.
Yes, he is.
And other people are very small.
There are some people in this world that are small.
And I would imagine moderation would be correlated.
To the size.
To those things. The second thing we do is we review, highlight a man gear of some kind. Dude stuff. Man toys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Guy things.
Right.
And then we have a super manly discussion. I've been wondering if we can really keep calling it the manliest top conversation of all time because... Like, what about all of our other conversations? I guess you could
that
say...
That haven't been recorded?
Is no, that
saying?
We already have recorded. You know, I guess you could say that we get progressively manlier.
Exponentially.
I don't like associating myself with the word progressive. is the only thing.
Trigger warning.
So, now that we've got that out of the way, let's get to the man beverage.
Okay. The bottle I have in front of me today, which is much better than a... The bottle in front of me is much better than a frontal lobotomy, is American Whiskey by Bull Run. My mother-in-law, Shelley Kitchell Batwell, sent me this from Oregon. She's out of Oregon. It's out of Portland, Oregon. It's a American whiskey aged 9 years. 9 years for an American whiskey, which is a long time for American whiskey.
For American whiskeys, yes.
Bull Run Distilling is what it is the distillery.
Do you think that means that Americans tend to be less patient than Scottish people?
The batch number is 005. It is 41.94% alcohol by volume, which is 83.88 proof.
Nice.
FYI.
Does it say that on the bottle, or did you do the math?
I just read that from the bottle.
Okay.
You thought I was going to say...
I read that from the bottle in my own head.
Yeah. So, let's try it.
Okay. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Cheers to Jesus.
Cheers to Jesus.
And our mother. Dave, what's the nose?
The nose is muted. To me, I don't really get a whole lot. Even if I put my nose pretty far into the glass, there's not a whole lot there. Typically, with a whiskey, you know, this is basically 80 proof. I mean, it's a little higher than that, but not really.
Right.
Nothing that really matters.
Mm-hmm.
You would get a, you know, if you put your nose in these glasses, these Glencairn glasses, then you'll, you know, your nose will...
Made by science.
Made by science. The glasses are, yeah.
Yes.
You'll kind of burn your nose a little bit. You can really tell, wow, okay, I got too close. It's like, that's too close. Like when you put your hand too close to the fire and you say, oh, too close.
Right.
Pull it back.
Ouch.
But this one, there's not a lot there. What do you think?
No, I mean, if anything, there's just a little sweetness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Some undertones of sweetness.
Yeah.
But the palate... okay, spoiler alert. We tried it before we started the show. we definitely tried it. So...
Guilty.
Guilty. So, Dave, what did you say about the palate whenever you tried it for the first time?
So, there's hints of fruit. I get a little bit of banana. Just a hint. It's not a banana drink, you know.
Mm-mm.
But there's just, on the finish, there's a little bit of banana.
I agree. And I thought that was a very astute point.
Thank you.
Because
you
typically don't bring out a lot of descriptions on your palate.
You know, many of my senses are hyper-refined.
Top-notch.
My palate is just average.
At best.
I do my best, though.
Yes, and I appreciate it.
I pour my heart out into it.
I'm grateful for it.
Yeah.
I agree, though. There is a ripened fruit. I do get a little bit of the grassy taste to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get
mm-hmm.
a little bit of grassy? What else does it say on here? It says it's almost like a brandy. If you like brandy, this would be a good one to try. Because it says...
Yeah, there is some brandy characteristics going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Brandy, we've never done any brandy on the show.
No, we have not.
That would be a good thing to try.
We should try that sometime. Maybe there's a listener that has a favorite brandy that they would like to send us.
At least they could make a suggestion.
Or make a suggestion. I would like them to send it to us if they would like.
So, was this... We were on the website earlier. It said it was made with... first thing, they use... New charred oak barrels,
mm-hmm.
which I guess a lot of American whiskeys do use
mm-hmm.
new
mm-hmm.
barrels. But it was inspired from beer, right?
Right, yeah. So you use malted barley, which is typically a bold, complex body to it.
Yeah.
So they used that because they didn't want to be in the same category as all the other traditional American whiskeys.
Yeah.
I think it's a good American whiskey, but I got to be honest with you. I don't like if I tried this whiskey without reading that, I would not consider this a bold, complex.
No, I wouldn't either. I would say
whiskey.
It's smooth.
It's a very smooth
whiskey.
It's very smooth.
I really enjoy it because it's not like too smooth where it gets boring.
No, but there's no like pepper. There's no, like, it's not a bite. If you're getting into the American whiskey game, which is, American whiskey is a very unique segment in the whiskey world. They're trying to separate themselves from bourbon and scotch.
Yeah.
They're actually trying to get their own, like, aisle in the liquor stores right now.
Right. Even though they call themselves bourbons often, which I don't like. You're not a, like, if you're made in Portland, well, you're not a bourbon. People are trying to expand the bourbon title.
Single malt American whiskey.
That's what I think they should call it.
A lot of them, like Stranahan's, I think does too.
Yeah, they do. But some of them are trying to call themselves a bourbon who are not distilled in Bourbon County, Kentucky. And I just don't like it. I'm a purist. That's not the way the game is played. You know what I mean?
What do you think? No, I mean, I don't really care. I don't really have. Yeah,
that's okay. I don't have much to say about it.
I got to be honest with you.
It's a tradition, and I like it when the traditions are observed.
I don't have enough information to really say one way or the other.
Yeah.
So I take a step back whenever you bring this up because I just don't have enough information, and I keep saying every time, I'm like, I'm gonna go and look this up and really, you know, learn me something.
Form an opinion.
Yeah, and I forget.
That's okay. I do that all the time with all kinds of stuff.
So it's just something I didn't do. But it is a great whiskey. It's a great American whiskey.
Oh, yeah, totally. And if you find it,
cheers,
it's definitely
to my mother-in-law.
Cheers, wonderful mother-in-law. You know what? When we get back from the break, you should give her a toast.
I'll give her a toast.
Okay.
All right. When we get back, we're going to jump into the man gear. The man topic is going to be with Professor Steve Weisskopf. Hang in there. Don't go anywhere. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side. So raise your glass. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm a man, David Niles, here with another man, Adam Minahan. You know you're a man when your name rhymes with it.
Yes. I was head bobbing.
You know it.
I was head bobbing.
I saw that.
Yeah, well, they didn't, so that's why.
That's probably okay.
Yeah. Probably an okay thing.
All right, but you're gonna cheers your mother-in-law.
Yes, off the cuff. So
this is risky business.
This is very risky. But I have a wonderful mother-in-law. So
no doubt.
I'm just gonna say up front, just like, I don't know what I'm gonna say yet, but whatever it is, I have a wonderful mother-in-law. She's awesome. I'm just gonna preface that.
No matter how this goes.
Yes, I have a wonderful mother-in-law.
I love you, Shelly.
So cheers to Shelly, a woman that I will forever be indebted to, for she gave me my beautiful bride, who I love very much.
Cheers to Jesus.
And to Shelly.
That was good.
It was safe.
It's a good one to remember if you, anytime you have to toast your mother-in-law or something.
So, okay.
Like on her birthday or...
That's
true. Who knows? Who knows, dude?
Who knows?
You know what? Being able to give a toast off the cuff is an important skill to have.
It is a very interesting skill, and actually is a skill.
And in fact, you know, there's like clubs about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never, but there, you know, there's the Toastmasters.
Yeah,
I've never
been. Yeah. I assume
they practice toasts.
Yeah,
it would be foolish, I think, if they didn't. But I think they do public speaking, other stuff as well.
Yes, they do.
Yeah,
they refine you for public speaking, which is something we may need to do. Some point.
That is a good idea.
Okay. Hey, before we get into the gear, I thought I would bring up something that happened to me this week.
Okay.
As a man, it is good to admit a fault. And I realized a fault this week.
Do share.
I knew I'd
grab excited about this.
So I hit somebody with my car. Like, this week, and they were in their car as well, but I rear-ended them.
You did?
Yeah, very, very, ever so slightly. It was more of a love tap than a, I mean, I just like,
I hope your insurance sees it that way.
I just like, I mean, crawled into them. And
is a stranger? You didn't know this person?
Did not know this person.
Yeah. Okay.
And I was like, dang it. I was really upset. I was kind of flustered. My wife was actually driving right behind me in the van. We were coming back from a wedding. I was like, dang it. Okay. And so we pull into a gas station.
Yeah.
And he gets out and he's like, you know, it didn't really hurt too bad. Didn't hurt my car very bad. It's all right, man. No worries. I was like, really?
Cool, bro.
Yeah. And he was like, he looked at my car and he saw that I had a crucifix in my windshield.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, so you know the Lord? I go, yes, sir, I do. And he goes, well, why waste an opportunity? Let's pray together.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so we just sat there and prayed together.
Man, it's like moments like that. You think he was Protestant?
Oh, he definitely was.
It's like moments like that when Protestants whoop our butts.
Yeah.
On public displays.
That's my
godly affection. Yeah.
That's my like I got to be honest with you. That is not what I would have done in this situation.
Totally, man.
I would have never, even if I would have said, you know what, don't worry about it. You know, even if, let's just say I'd said that. Odds are I would not. But yeah. Let's just say I said that. I would not say, you know what? Why waste this opportunity? Let's pray together. And I just got to up my game.
Me too, man.
I have to up my, like, I would not do that.
That wouldn't even occur to me.
It wouldn't have occurred to me. And I could tell that he, like, looked in my windshield. He saw that. And that was the first thing he said. Like, once he saw that, he, like, completely disregarded his car, what happened. And that's where he went.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, as men, we're called to evangelize. We're called to set the world on fire. Why waste any opportunities not to share Christ with other people? So I don't do that. I'm not very good at that. That's not how I would have reacted. That's not what I would have done.
Another good moment to have a good toasting ability. You know, because like a good toast, a good prayer, a good cheers. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of in the same ballpark. Like, can you come up with something really nice to say in the moment?
Yeah.
Because it's like, here this guy is. This is big evangelizing opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if he lands it with a nice, like, manly prayer. Did he?
Yeah, he nailed it.
I mean, it's like,
he asked
it's
me.
It's like the icing on the cake.
Yeah, he asked me, what can we pray for? What are you struggling with?
Driving.
Yeah. Apparently driving. Yeah. He nailed it. He did a great job. He wasn't one of those, like, he wasn't super pushy about everything. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't like it was a very genuine experience of, let's just pray. Why waste this opportunity? Why not pray together?
I told you to quit watching YouTube videos when you drive.
I know. It's just tough. That's a joke.
Kidding.
I don't do that.
Of course not. That would be stupid.
Yeah. Okay. But I felt like that I had to.
And that's a cool story, bro.
I felt like I had to admit that.
I like your story.
Thank you.
And it was. I mean, that was good stuff.
Yeah.
But on that guy's part, it was not good stuff on your part.
No, there was nothing good about me in that story.
Except that you admitted it.
And I accepted it.
Yeah, that you were able to recognize this is good what this guy is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to the man gear in the minutes that we have left.
Okay.
The man gear for today is an ice chest. Which every guy needs, if for nothing else, to keep your beer cold when you take it somewhere. And even if there was nothing else other than that it did, it would be enough.
To get one.
To need one.
Yeah.
You know what I wish I had? A really, really big ice chest.
Dude, they're tough to find.
I know. I've seen some.
On our camp out, I tried to go, like, I went to all the sporting good stores, Walmart, Kmart, or not Kmart. Kmart didn't even exist anymore, I don't think. Target, anyway,
yeah, I don't know.
All these places, Academy, all these places, I was going through looking, and they don't have the big, gigantic ones. They don't have them.
Yeah, the ones that are like 5 feet long.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
How do you feel about Yetis?
Oh, I feel like they're cool. I feel like they're awesome, but I'm not paying $300 for a tiny ice chest.
I know, dude.
If somebody were to give me one, or if I were to like win one in a raffle, I would be ecstatic about it.
Right. I mean, when we were at our camp out, my brother-in-law has a Yeti, and he left it for us to use at the campout because it was like, we need more ice chests.
Yeah.
as it was pouring down rain, and we thought that there was like tornado warnings. I was like, I gotta save the Yeti. I gotta get it. Because like, I wasn't gonna pay $300 to give him a new one. You know, like,
it's worth more than your tent.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't care about any of my stuff. Let's just make sure we get the Yeti.
Yeah.
I mean, they're awesome. And they do their job extremely well.
Right.
I can't stomach paying that much.
You know what though? Like Walmart.
I'd love to be sponsored by them.
Walmart really came through on the Yeti mugs, cooler, cups.
Yeah.
What would you call those?
Yeah.
When is Walmart going to come through?
Thermoses or
thermos? Yeah. You know, the Yeti thermos. Then the patent ran out.
And so
So now Walmart, it's like literally the exact same thing from the same factory.
Mm-hmm.
Way cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Yeti. I mean, it's like
capitalism.
You win some, you lose some,
yeah.
Right? You should have done your paperwork better or something. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what happened. But Walmart.
Talk to your lawyers.
When are you going to come through on the Yeti coolers?
Well, they have some similar to it. It's like RC. Oh man, I didn't do my research on it, but there's a brand. It's like RCA or something like that. That are the coolers of Yeti.
RC Cola.
No. Whatever happened to that?
I think it's still around.
Is it? My grandparents used to have that all the time.
I have no idea.
But they have those and they're cheaper. They're still more expensive than like Coleman or something like that.
Sure.
But they're
but so, also they're so small.
Well, they have big ones.
Yeah, but
they're like $600.
You like lose all the you lose a lot of space.
Dude, have you seen the big ones?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're very big, but you still lose a lot of space.
Well,
but the inside is big, but it's the outside,
because it keeps it cold,
really cold.
Yeah.
I get it. It's very effective.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the coolest thing you've ever done with a cooler?
It's not something that I should.
Okay.
Not something
Don't even go there, bro. One time, my brother turned a cooler into a speaker.
Hmm.
He cut it. He like mounted a speaker on the outside.
Hmm. No, I have a cool speaker or cooler story.
Let me guess. The mobile.
Yes.
The mobile cooler.
One of my first jobs, my boss, for my bonus, which I thought was weak. But anyway, he gave me a mobilized cooler.
It's like a go-kart cooler.
It's a go-kart cooler. Yeah.
That was awesome, especially in Stillwater.
Yeah. Because
you were in college at the time.
Or I was just getting out of college. Yeah.
You were out of college. But that's when we were still tailgating pretty
heavy
or frequently.
Because mm-hmm.
we still had a lot of friends there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty awesome.
It was pretty cool.
It was weird though when we both rode it.
We never did that. We
just
never
kidding. People looked at us funny.
Yeah, but that is, dude. Some of those coolers are really really nice. They have like speakers in them now. They have like places to hold your fishing poles. Like they have fishing pole adapters.
Yeah. So the one my brother made, you couldn't use it as a cooler anymore because there was wires on the inside. But he used it just as like storage. You could throw dry stuff in there, you know, your socks or whatever. But you'd close it and it would seal, and it was like a sealed box for the speaker. It actually hit really hard.
Hmm.
I was very impressed with it. He's a creative guy, though.
He is. He's a lot different than you.
One day he'll graduate from college. One day.
This is year 8.
He's getting so close.
This is the year.
No, it's not 8.
It's like 7. 6, 7.
It's close to 8. It's way too close. It's closer than it should be.
Yeah. So.
Sorry, anyway. Jake, for ragging on.
Dude, I really like you, Jake.
Yeah.
Dude, when we get back, we're going to talk to Steve Weitenthal.
I'm pumped.
What are you going to ask him?
I don't know. I have a lot of questions, though. Okay.
When we get back, we're going to have Steve Weitenthal on. Hang in there. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. Your glass. And Dave, as promised through the first two segments, as promised, we have the professor Steve Weitenthal with us. Steve, thanks so much for carving out some time to hang out with us this evening.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
So Steve, we had the opportunity to read your book the real story of Catholic history. It's the answering 20 centuries of anti-Catholic myths. I'm sorry, answering 20 centuries of anti-Catholic myths, which we, before that, Dave, you and I and a couple of our families got together. We get together about once a month, and we actually were listening to his lectures on epic early. It's called Epic Early Church History. Is that correct? Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, my EPIC program has two studies. There's the foundational study, which covers all 2,000 years of church history. Then there's the early church study, which is what you just mentioned there, and that covers the first 500 years of church history.
Yeah. So, if you're a guy right now and you have a couple of friends and you want to get together, you know, once a month to have like a Bible study or learn a little bit about early church history, I strongly recommend that. That's what we're doing right now. I think are we a little bit over halfway through? I think we're on like 8. Right now,
you know,
I can't remember how many segments there are, but I think we're on 8.
I just live in the moment so much, I have no idea.
But yeah, Steve, so what we thought we would do, your book is awesome because what it really does is you tackle all these myths about Catholic, you know, myths of the 20th century, and what you do is you give the real story, you preface it, and then at the very end you give the real story, a little synopsis of what you just talked about, which I really like.
Yeah, I do too, because it's like a good way of summing things up. Yeah, and a lot of, you know, for people who have been Catholic for any length of time, they're gonna have heard a lot of these objections or false accusations.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just wanted to—I don't know if we want to call it a speed round
or rapid fire.
But
I don't know.
We want to showcase Steve's just intellectual. We want to, like, let's show you his brain.
Yeah.
Because
he's way smarter than us.
Because someday I hope to possess some of it.
Yeah, he's way smarter than us. And so we thought, well, we need to capitalize on it. Maybe for the next couple of episodes, we can dumb it down a little bit.
Like, Steve, before we get going, let me ask, is it difficult to just hold it back sometimes in day-to-day conversations with people? Because when I know a lot about something, I find it very hard not to explain, like, oh, but it's so cool how, you know, but this, and you're going to love, and people are like, yeah, okay, look, I get it. You're way into history. Is it difficult to, like, not be that guy?
Yes, you know, definitely it is, you know, and sometimes you just want to keep, you know, going and going and going, giving all kinds of information and whatnot, and you just get on this, you know, tangent because you're so passionate about the material. But, you know, I've learned over the years to just kind of try to give, like, little nuggets to people, one or two things on a particular topic that's come up or whatever that we're talking about that gets them, especially if they're, you know, if they've embraced some of these myths or whatever, and just to get them thinking, right, just to kind of open the door for them to think, and then, oh, maybe they'll come back later if I know the person, you know, oh, well, you know, we were talking about this, and, you know, explore that thread a little bit in more detail, or, you know, they'll go off and do some research on their own maybe, but, yeah, it is exceptionally hard to rein back at times.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because it's like, it would be for me.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. I want to start with Jesus.
That's a good place to start, Dave.
Yeah. Isn't it true that Jesus is really just the Christianization of other, you know, like Krishna and all these other God stories, you know, who talked about rising from the dead? I mean, Jesus, he probably wasn't even real, you know, right? Isn't he just the Christianization of all these other God stories?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of the most popular myths of today, you know, among secular humanists and atheists and others that you know, and again, the implication of that, I mean, it's a myth, right? We all know that Jesus,
right,
it was a real historical person. That can be proven, obviously, just not only from Christian sources, right, the New Testament, but also from non-Christian sources. There were plenty contemporary at the time, numerous Roman sources, you know, and even non-Roman sources like Josephus and others that, you know, show us or tell us that Jesus is alive or was alive, was a real person at that time. So even if people object to, you know, the New Testament and the Bible, you can then point them in the direction of all these other non-Christian sources that validate the fact that he was a real historical person. You know, and yeah, you know, this whole notion of these ancient mystery religions and Egyptian mystery cults and things like that the Christians took all these different elements from these religions and just kind of crafted this person of Jesus is, you know, it's seductive on the surface because there are certain elements that, you know, oh, there's a, you know, there's a virgin birth in this story, or there's a, you know, God becoming incarnate sort of in this story over here from this mystery cult in Egypt. So therefore, obviously, the Christians borrowed from them. But when you look at it, it's you know, when you pull the thread and look in more detail, like I do in my book, you see that that's just completely fanciful. I mean, it's you know, for a multitude of different reasons. But one big reason I find is that, you know, the early Christians were very clear on distancing themselves from paganism by showing how different they were from paganism. And so they had no, you know, notion of borrowing any of these stories from paganism at all. And to the extent that there might be some of these elements that are obviously associated with Christ or in the Christian story in these other mystery religions or whatnot, that I think that has more to do with the fact that, you know, there's that God, you know, there's certain divine elements or certain elements of the divine story that, you know, God was giving to humanity and kind of preparing the way for Jesus, so to speak. But it doesn't mean that Christians borrowed those and just kind of crafted this myth of Jesus. That's absurd, frankly.
Yeah, and so this is just a little taste of what his book is. You know, so our goal is to kind of pinpoint a few of these questions in order for you to go get his book, because he goes into more detail and it's a great resource. So my next question was, actually, this is the one that I ran into and absolutely loved. I'm glad you really touched on it, because it's kind of a hot button question right now. And there's so many different blogs out there that are saying contrary to what this says. But it says, you know, Christopher Columbus was an agent of Western imperialism, cultural destruction, and genocide. Speak to that.
Yeah, so Columbus is the favorite whipping boy of people in the modern world to, you know, of any sort of kind of, you know, Western colonialism or any kind of, you know, Western civilization, frankly. You know, every Columbus Day, you know, there's always stories about, you know, how horrible of a person he was, how he, you know, was solely bent on colonial conquest and subjugating native peoples and committing genocide and all these things, as you mentioned. And there's even communities now around the country, towns and cities and whatnot, that are getting rid of Columbus Day and replacing it with Indigenous Peoples Day and things like that. So it's really an effort to kind of strip away, I think, you know, one of the foundational stories of you know, the New World, frankly, and the history of the New World. But, you know, just I go into great detail, as you mentioned, in the book about Columbus. But one of the things just to highlight to your listeners is that, and I found this quite fascinating when I was researching this with Columbus, is that Columbus really was not focused on, obviously, subjugating the native peoples. He had no interest in enslaving the native peoples that he came into contact with when he came to the New World. Really, what motivated Columbus, you know, everybody thinks, oh, he went to, you know, to the Caribbean and he sailed, you know, west in order to, you know, find a quicker route to India to get spices and to enrich himself. Well, that's only partially true. I mean, he did want to find a faster route to the east by going west so that he could, you know, engage in trade. But the reason why he wanted to engage in trade and make money was not to enrich himself, but rather was to take the money that he was hoping to have earned and to use that to finance a crusade to retake the holy city of Jerusalem, which was still under the occupation of Islamic forces at his time in the 15th century. So he was motivated out of a desire of his love for Christ and for the church and for the liberation of that ancient Christian city. The other aspect, too, about Columbus is that what I found quite fascinating is that when he went on his second voyage to the New World, he went to another part of the Caribbean that he didn't go to in the first part of on his first voyage, and he ran into a group of people known as the Caribs, and they were indigenous people that were very hostile, were very violent to other tribes in the air, in the region, very hostile, very warlike, and they were actually, you know, they committed cannibalism. And when he went to see them, or when he ran into them in his second voyage, he found in captivity in their camp, in the camp of the Caribs, natives that he had come into contact with on his first voyage, which were very friendly and helpful to him. They were being held captive by these Caribs. And he actually negotiated with the Carib chief to free these other native peoples who were enslaved by the Caribs, so that he could then take them back to their home island and bring them back to their families. So, you know, that's not the actions of a man who is bent on enslaving and, you know, the New World peoples and committing genocide en masse. This is a man who had a deep love for Christ, and it's really a travesty and a scandal in the modern world that his name is so, you know, just denigrated by so many people in the modern world.
And I got to be honest with you, Steve, before I read your book, I wasn't really sure how to feel about Columbus. I mean, I knew that, you know, the Knights of Columbus, you know, that's a loyal, you know, a very good organization by the church, and it's the roots are really good. But I started realize, you know, I started reading a little bit more, and I was worried, like, well, what about, you know, maybe they didn't know all this stuff about Columbus then that they do now.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like one of those things, like, I don't know where to stand on this, because there's a lot of a lot of blogs out there, a lot of literature out there that's just that bashes him. So I'm really glad that you, and that's another thing about his book, guys, is that the last, like, I don't know, 40 pages, 50 pages are nothing but endnotes. So
yeah.
You can keep going a lot deeper into this if you want to. So I'm really glad you hit on that topic.
I found one sentence earlier that had three notes in it.
So
in one sentence, it's like, this is a well-researched book. I mean, unless your name is Steve Weidenkopf or Jimmy Akin, there is going to be like a lot that you can get from this book.
Yeah.
All right. And you mentioned Christopher Columbus was trying to finance a crusade, which leads me to my next question. I don't know if we'll have time to answer it, but you might get the answer on the other side of the break. Because the Crusades is one of those things that even most Catholics, I think, go throw their hands up. Like
maybe
that wasn't all that great. And, you know, like, maybe we should be apologizing for that. So when we get back from the break, maybe you can talk about the Crusades. You're listening to The Catholic Man Show with Adam Minahan and David Niles. We're here talking with the one and only Steve Weidenkopf. We're on the Lord's team,
the winning side.
So raise your glass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles, sitting alongside my partner in crime, Adam Minahan. We're on our best behavior because we're talking with Steve Weidenkopf, who...
believe it or not, this is our best behavior.
Yeah. we are drinking still, so...
Yeah.
speaking of which, we're drinking Bull Run
American
whiskey. It's very good. Mm-hmm. But Steve... Right before the break, the music so rudely interrupted my question. I wanted to ask you about the Crusades, because there's a lot of people out there who think those poor Muslims, you know, they're just sitting there drinking their coffee, saying their prayers, minding their own business, and here the evil Christians come to take their lands and kill them all and take all their money. Is that how it played out?
Yeah, that's not necessarily historically accurate, that portrayal there. But unfortunately, it is the common portrayal that most people see, you know, in Hollywood movies and on the history, so-called History Channel, and all the other kinds of things that that kind of produce this myth of the Crusades. And actually, this was a topic that is near and dear to my heart. I'm kind of a specialist in the Crusades. I teach an elective course on the Crusades at the grad school here. And I wrote a book a couple years ago called The Glory of the Crusades, where I talk about all the major myths of the Crusades, which was also published by Catholic Answers Press. But, you know, no, I mean, generally, what the way to understand the Crusades is we have to, again, put ourselves into the historical context of the time and recognize that what they were armed pilgrimages called by the Pope to recover ancient Christian territory that had been conquered by Islamic forces, also to help the Byzantine Empire, which was being threatened by a group of Muslims known as the Seljuk Turks, and also to protect the indigenous Christians and Jews who were living in the Holy Land in North Africa, who were being attacked and harassed by the Muslims, as well as Christian pilgrims who were coming from the West to visit the holy sites, who also were being harassed and executed by the Muslim forces as well. So the Crusades were a defensive wars, defensive efforts aimed, again, at recovering that ancient Christian territory. They're part of the just, or they're classified within the just war tradition of the Church. And are not, you know, these kind of offensive, aggressive campaigns that people most associate with them, as if, you know, like you said, the Muslims were in the Middle East, they're in the Holy Land in North Africa, not doing anything, just kind of minding their own business. You know, they were a response to Muslim aggression, which is, you know, one of the things that we need to keep in mind whenever we talk about those topics.
Yeah, that's right. And the Crusades were necessary because when asked politely, they wouldn't leave. And it was like, this is our, hey, we were here first. You know, we called dibs on the Holy Land. Anyway, we did a while back a special episode just for our Council of Man members all about the Winged Hussars from Poland who came in and decimated some of the Muslim forces that were trying to come and wipe out Europe. And if you're interested in that, go and join the Council of Man. Go to thecatholicmanshow.com, sign up to support the show by giving $10 a month, and you'll get access to that and all the other private content we produce. Mm-hmm. Adam, I'm gonna kick it over to you for the next epic question.
Because, I mean, like, you just kind of teased us with that winged hussar.
The winged hussar,
you really
threw
that hook out there for me to really want to grab onto and keep going with.
A 100-year undefeated streak.
Yeah,
we're not going to go down that trail. Yeah.
I want to talk about really fast Pope Pius XII, who was Hitler's pope, because I hear that all the time. I even have some of my friends who are Catholics that have come to me personally and asked me about it, because I think actually the History Channel put out something not too long ago regarding this. What are your thoughts on that, Professor Steve?
Yeah, so, you know, Pius XII is, again, one of those, I call them kind of the four, big topics of anti-Catholic historical myths. I mean, you always have the Crusades, the Inquisition, Galileo, and Pius XII. I mean, those are the four biggie ones that you're always going to see, like you said, the special on the so-called History Channel that comes out that gives you all this information and whatnot. And in terms of Pius XII, I mean, this was, thankfully, frankly, this is actually becoming a little less common than it was, let's just say, even 10 years ago, because there's been so much great research has come out that's completely debunked all this notion that somehow Pius XII was Hitler's pope, or that he was complicit in the Final Solution at worst, or at best just really didn't do anything to help the Jews. And all that's been proven completely false. I mean, Pius XII, his given name was Eugenio Pacelli. He was a diplomat in the Vatican diplomatic corps for a good number of years before he became pope. He was the apostolic nuncio, or the pope's representative, to Bavaria right after the First World War. And so he was there in Germany in the late 1920s, early 30s, when Hitler and the National Socialist Workers' Party came to fruition. So he saw it firsthand. He knew what these people were about. He knew what their racial policies were. And while he was nuncio, he spoke out against them multiple times in public speeches that he gave while nuncio in Bavaria. Later on, he becomes the Vatican Secretary of State under Pope Pius XI. He continues to do the same thing, makes speeches, talks through diplomatic channels with other countries, diplomats about the Nazis, about what they really were about their racial policies towards the Jews, and setting the stage so that for when he did become pope, and took the name Pius XII right before the Second World War began in 1939, he knew very well Hitler. He knew what Hitler was about, and he knew what he was going to do if given the opportunity. And so when the Second World War did erupt and then the Nazis began the Final Solution, Pius worked diligently, both publicly and privately, behind the scenes diplomatically, but also publicly when he could, to protect and help the Jews as much as he could. I mean, he gave orders so that Jews could be hidden in monasteries and church property, including his own summer residence in Castel Gandolfo and near Rome, to protect them. He ordered the nuncios around the world to work with the bishops in order to help Jews escape Nazi persecution as much as possible. But he also had to be careful, too, because, for example, in the one country, the one Nazi-occupied country where the bishops, the Catholic bishops, spoke out most forcefully against Nazi racial policies, this was in Holland, more Jews from that country were rounded up and sent to the concentration camp than any other Nazi-occupied country. So Pius knew that to speak out publicly, as forcefully as he could at every opportunity, could produce, and more than likely would have produced, a greater persecution of the Jews by the Nazis. So he had to be very careful with that. So he tried to walk as fine a line as he possibly could. But as I show in my book, ultimately, one Jewish historian has looked at the efforts of Pius XII in the Catholic Church during the Second World War, and he estimated that based on those actions, the Church in Pius XII saved 860,000 Jews from the Holocaust, which equates to about 30% of those who actually survived the Holocaust. So, not an inconsequential effort on the part of the Pope and the Church. And again, that completely debunks the whole notion that he was somehow Hitler's Pope.
Yeah, 860,000, that's a big number.
Yeah.
We've just got about 4 minutes left. And Steve, I want to ask you, this being the 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Revolution, what's up with that guy? I was reading your book, and you drew an interesting parallel between throwing out celibacy during the Protestant Revolution and drawing how that led to the sexual revolution. Talk a little bit about the consequences of the Protestant Revolution.
Yeah, there's many different consequences of the Protestant Revolution, but we're dealing with them all now, you know, today in the modern world, frankly. A lot of them. I mean, there's you know, the isolation of the soul, the taking of, you know, individual or taking really, you know, authority that's given to by God in the magisterium, the bishops and the Pope united, or the bishops united with the Pope, the teaching authority of the Church. Instead of having that, right, it's been the authority from Luther and the other so-called reformers placed the authority to interpret the Scripture and Christian revelation into the individual himself. And that produces all kinds of things, right? Which is why we have, you know, thousands of different Protestant denominations. Because if I disagree with your interpretation of Scripture, I can create my own church and we can separate and we just keep going because it's all based on an individual interpretation. And like you mentioned, too, with celibacy, you know, Luther got rid of celibacy, wrote this pamphlet called, this treatise called On Monastic Vows, where basically said that celibacy was unnatural, that it shouldn't, you know, be followed or be used. And so that actually had a huge impact on the monasteries in Germany. Many men and women in convents left, actually, the religious life, married. And so that grew up, obviously, in the Protestant world, that you didn't have to have a celibate clergy or any kind of ministry. And that, again, that individual kind of authority leads the one to then think of, you know, well, I can interpret, you know, human sexuality the way that I want to interpret human sexuality, different from, let's say, the Church or from God-given revelation. So it just opens this Pandora's box of all kinds of things that can go on. And it even really impacted greatly the political world, as well as even just how our society is structured in many different ways. And so a great book on that, frankly, is Brad Gregory wrote this book called The Unintended Reformation. And I encourage you guys and your listeners to, if you're really interested in that subject, to get that book. And he goes into phenomenal detail with a lot of research about how the modern world really and the secularization present in the modern world really stems from the Protestant Reformation.
Steve, where can they get your book?
So you can go to, it's published by Catholic Answers Press, so the best way is to go to the Catholic Answers website, which is just catholic.com. They have a little link there for their online shop. Just click that, and the book will be right there. Or you can also get it through Amazon as well.
I've downloaded your MP3 on the Crusades. If you're an MP3 guy, audiobook guy, I strongly advise that as well, because I got a chance to listen to that as I was driving down to Texas on a business trip. So a lot of great information. So Steve, thank you so much for coming on our show today. I have only about 72 more questions I'd like to ask you, but the time is short. So we appreciate your time and thank you so much.
And if you're interested in getting a hold of Steve's video history series, go to ourcatholichistory.com. You can get a hold of his epic series there. It makes a great Bible study. Again, Steve, thanks for being here. This is the Catholic Man Show with Adam Minahan and David Niles. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass. Cheers to Jesus.